perhaps, Cassandra said finally. Where is it? Is it nearby? Ben shook his head, smiled bemusedly. That's where this whole thing gets really mysterious. The other house is in England. England? The UK. Europe. Other side of the world. I know where England is. Cornwall. To be precise, a village called Tregenna. I've only got the deeds to go by, but it's listed as Cliff Cottage. From the address, I'd guess it was part of a larger country estate originally. I could find out if you like.
But why would she... How could she...
Cassandra exhaled. When did she buy it? The deeds are stamped the 6th of December, 1975. She folded her arms across her chest. Nell hasn't even been to England. It was Ben's turn to look surprised.
Yes, she has. She went on a trip to the UK back in the mid-70s. She never mentioned it.
Cassandra shook her head slowly.
I remember when she went. I hadn't known her long. It was a few months before you came on the scene, when she still had the little shop near Stafford Street. I'd bought a few pieces from her, and we were acquaintances, if not yet friends. She was gone just over a month. I remember because I'd put a cedar writing desk on lay-by right before she left, a birthday gift for my wife. Least it was supposed to be. Didn't turn out that way in the end. Every time I went to collect it, the shop was closed. Don't have to tell you I was ropeable. It was Janice's 50th, and the desk was perfect. When I paid the deposit, Nell didn't mention that she was going on holidays. In fact, she made a point of outlining her lay-by terms, made it clear she was expecting weekly payments and that I'd need to collect the desk within a month. She wasn't a storage facility, she said. She'd have more stock coming in and needed the room.
Cassandra smiled. It sounded just like Nell.
She was absolutely insistent. That's what made it so odd when she wasn't there all that time. After I got over the initial irritation, I became quite worried. Even thought about calling the police.
He waved his hand.
Didn't have to, as it turned out. On my fourth or fifth visit, I bumped into the lady next door, who was collecting Nell's mail. She told me Nell was in the UK, but became quite indignant when I started asking questions about why she'd left so suddenly and when she'd be back. The neighbour said she was just doing as she'd been asked and knew no more than that. So I kept on checking. My wife's birthday came and went, and then one day the shop was open. Nell was home.
And she'd bought a house while she was away.
Evidently.
Cassandra pulled her cardigan closer around her shoulders. It made no sense. Why would Nell go on holiday like that, out of the blue, buy a house, then never go back? She didn't tell you anything about it? Not ever?
Ben raised his eyebrows. We're talking about Nell. She wasn't one for volunteering confidences.
But you and she were close. Surely at some point she must have mentioned it.
Ben was shaking his head.
Cassandra persisted. But when she got back, when you finally collected the writing desk, didn't you ask her why she'd left so suddenly?
Course I did, a number of times over the years. I knew it must have been important. She was different, you see, when she got back.
How?
More distracted. Mysterious. I'm sure it's not just hindsight that makes me say so. A couple of months later was the closest I came to finding out. I was visiting her in her shop and a letter arrived, postmarked Truro. I arrived at the same time as the postie, so I took the mail in for her. She tried to act casually, but I was getting to know her better by then. She was excited to receive that letter. made an excuse to leave me as soon as she could.
What was it? Who was it from?
Must admit, curiosity got the better of me. I didn't go as far as to look at the letter itself, but I flipped the envelope over later when I saw it on her desk, just to see who'd sent it. I memorized the address on the back and had an old colleague in the UK look it up for me. The address was for an investigator.
You mean like a detective? He nodded. They really exist?
Sure.
But what would Nell have wanted with an English detective?
Ben shrugged. I don't know. I guess she had some mystery she was trying to get to the bottom of. I dropped hints for a while, tried to draw her out, but all to no avail. I let it go after that. I figured everyone's entitled to their secrets, and Nella'd tell me if she wanted to. Truth be told, I still felt guilty for the bit of snooping I'd already done.
He shook his head.
Gotta admit, I'd love to know. It's played on my mind a long time, and this, he waved the deed, this just caps it off. Even now your grandmother has the strangest ability to confound me.
Cassandra nodded absently. Her mind was elsewhere, making connections. It was Ben's talk of mysteries that had done it, his suggestion that Nell must have been trying to solve one. All the secrets that had materialized in her grandmother's wake were beginning to knit together. Nell's unknown parentage, her arrival as a child at an ocean port, the suitcase, the mysterious trip to England, this secret house.
Ah, well.
Ben tossed the dregs of his tea into a pot of Nell's red geraniums.
I'd better head off. I've a man coming to see me about a mahogany sideboard in 15 minutes. It's been a bugger of a sale to make. I'll be that glad to see the end of it.
Anything you'd like me to do when I'm up at the centre?
Cassandra shook her head.
I'll come up myself on Monday.
No rush, Cass. I told you the other day, I'm happy to keep an eye on your space as long as you need. I'll bring you any money they're holding when I'm finished this afternoon.
Thanks, Ben, she said. For everything. He stood and tucked the squatter's chair back where it had come from, left the deed beneath his teacup. He was about to disappear around the corner and down the side of the house when he hesitated and turned back.
You look after yourself now, you hear? That wind gets much stronger, you'll blow away.
Kindly concern lined his forehead, and Cassandra found it hard to meet his gaze. It offered too clear a window to his thoughts, and she couldn't bear to see him remembering the way she used to be.
Cass?
Yep, will do. She waved as he left, listened as his car engine faded down the street. His sympathy, though well-intentioned, always seemed to carry with it an indictment. Disappointment, however faint, that she'd been unable or unwilling to recover her old self. It didn't occur to him that she might have chosen to remain this way. That where he saw reserve and loneliness, Cassandra saw self-preservation and the knowledge that it was safer when one had less to lose. She scuffed the toe of her sneaker against the cement path and shook away sad old thoughts. Then she picked up the deed. Noticed, for the first time, the little note stapled to its front. Nell's aged scrawl, near on impossible to read. She held it close, then further away, slowly picked out the words. For Cassandra, it said, who will understand why.
Chapter 8, Brisbane, 1975. Nell ran quickly through the documents again. Passport, ticket, traveller's checks. Then zipped up her travel wallet and gave herself a stern talking to. Really, it was becoming compulsive. People flew every day, or so she was led to believe, strapped themselves into seats within gigantic tin cans and consented to being catapulted into the sky. She took a deep breath. Everything would be fine. She was a survivor, wasn't she? She made her way through the house, checking the window locks as she went, scanned the kitchen, made sure she hadn't left the gas leaking, the freezer ice melting, PowerPoint switched on. Finally, she carried her two suitcases through the back door and locked up. She knew why she was nervous, of course, and it wasn't only a fear of forgetting something, or even a fear of the plane dropping from the sky. She was nervous because she was going home. After all this time, a lifetime, she was finally going home. It had happened so suddenly in the end. Her father, Hugh, had only been dead a couple of months, and here she was opening the door to her past. He must have known she would do so. When he pointed out the suitcase to Phyllis, told her to deliver it to Nell when he was gone, he must have guessed. As she waited by the road for the taxi, Nell glanced up at her pale yellow house. So tall from this angle, unlike any house she'd seen before with its funny little backward staircase closed in years before, stripy awnings painted pink, blue, and white, the two dormer windows at the top. Too narrow, too boxy ever to be considered elegant, and yet she loved it. Its awkwardness, its patched-up quality, its lack of clear provenance. Victim of time and a succession of owners, each intent on placing their stamp on its enduring facade. She'd bought it in 1961, after Al died, and she and Leslie returned from America. The house had been neglected, but its position on the Paddington slopes behind the old Plaza Theatre had felt about as close to home as Nell could get. And the house had rewarded her faith, had even provided her with a new income. She'd stumbled upon the room of broken furniture locked up in the dark underneath and spied a table that took her fancy, barley twist legs and a drop leaf. It was in pretty bad nick, but Nell hadn't thought twice. She'd bought some sandpaper and shellac and set about bringing it back to life. It had been Hugh who'd taught her how to restore furniture. When he came back from the war and the baby sisters had started being born, Nell had taken to following him around on weekends. She'd become his helper, learned her dovetail joints from her box combing, her shellac from her varnish, the joy of taking a broken object and putting it back together. It had been a long time since she'd done so, though, and she'd forgotten until she saw that table that she knew how to perform such surgery, forgotten that she loved it so much. She could have wept as she massaged the shellac into the barley twist legs, breathed the familiar fumes, only she hadn't been the weeping kind. A wilting gardenia near her suitcase caught Nell's attention, and she remembered that she'd neglected to arrange for someone to water her garden. The girl who lived behind had agreed to put milk out for the visiting cats, and she'd organized a woman to collect mail at the shop, but the plants had slipped her mind. Just went to show where her head was at, to forget her pride and joy like that. She would have to ask one of her sisters, phone from the airport, or even the other side of the world. Give them a real shock, the sort they'd come to expect from their big sister Nell. Hard to believe they'd all been so close once. Of the many things her father's confession had stolen from her, their loss had left the deepest wound. She'd already been 11 when the first of them came along, but the instant bond had almost knocked her over. She'd known, even before Ma told her, that it was her responsibility to look after these little sisters, to make sure they were safe. Her reward was their devotion, their insistence that Nell cradle them when they were hurt, their firm little bodies pressing against hers after they'd suffered a nightmare and crept into bed beside her to pass the long night. But Pa's secret had changed everything. His words had tossed the book that was her life into the air, and the pages had been blown into disarray, could never be put back together to tell the same story. She found she couldn't look at her little sisters without seeing her own foreignness, and yet she couldn't tell them the truth. To have done so would have destroyed something in which they believed implicitly. Nell had figured it was better they thought her strange than knew her to be a stranger. A black and white taxi turned into the street, and she held out her arm to wave it over. The driver loaded her suitcase while she climbed into the back seat.
"Where to, love?"
he said, slamming his door closed. "The airport." He nodded, and they set off, weaving through the maze of Paddington streets. Her father had told her when she turned 21, the whispered confession that robbed her of herself. "But who am I?" she'd said.
"You're you, same as always. You're Nell, my Nellie."
She could hear how much he wanted it to be so, but she'd known better than that. Reality had shifted by a few degrees and left her out of sync with everyone else. This person she was, or thought she was, did not really exist. There was no Nell O'Connor. "Who am I really?" she'd said again, days later. "Please tell me, Pa." He'd shaken his head.
"I don't know that, Nellie. Your mum and me, we never knew that. And it never mattered to us."
She tried not to let it matter to her either, but the truth was, it did. Things had changed, and she could no longer meet her father's eyes. It wasn't that she loved him any less, only that the easiness had disappeared. The affection she had for him, invisible, unquestioned in the past, had gained a weight, a voice. It whispered when she looked at him, "You're not really his." She couldn't believe, no matter how vehemently he insisted, that he loved her as he said, as much as he loved her sisters.
"Course I do," he'd said when she asked him.
His eyes revealed his astonishment, his hurt. He took out his handkerchief and wiped it across his mouth.
"I knew you first, Nellie. I've loved you longest."
But it wasn't enough. She was a lie, had been living a lie, and she refused to do so any longer. Over the course of a few months, a life that had been 21 years in the making was systematically dismantled. She gave away her job at Mr. Fitzsimmons' news agency and found a new one as an usherette at the New Plaza Theatre. She packed her clothes into two small cases and arranged to share a flat with the girlfriend of a girlfriend. And she broke off her engagement to Danny. Not right away. She'd lacked the courage then to make a clean break. She'd let it fall apart for months, refused to see him much of the time, behaved unpleasantly when she did consent to meet. Her cowardice had made her hate herself more, a reassuring self-hatred that confirmed her suspicion that she deserved all that was happening. It took a long time to get over, splitting up with Danny. His knockabout face, the honest eyes and easy smile. He'd wanted to know why, of course, but she couldn't bring herself to say. There were no words to tell him that the woman he loved, whom he hoped to marry, no longer existed. How could she expect him to value her, still to want her, once he realized she was someone disposable, that her own true family had discarded her? The taxi turned into Albion and sped east towards the airport.
"Where you headed then?"
the driver asked, eyes meeting Nell's in the rearview mirror.
"London." "Family there?"
Nell looked out of the smeary car window.
"Yes,"
she said, hopefully. She hadn't told Leslie she was going either. She'd thought about it, imagined herself picking up the telephone and dialing her daughter's number, the most recent in a line that snaked down her index file and curled into the margin, but each time she'd dismissed the idea. In all likelihood, she'd be home before Leslie even realized she was gone. Nell didn't need to wonder where the problems with Leslie had started. she knew well enough. They'd got off on the wrong foot and never found the right one. The birth had been a shock, the violent arrival of the screaming, bawling parcel of life, all limbs and gums and panicked fingers. Night after night, Nell had lain awake in the American hospital, waiting to feel the connection people spoke of. To know that she was powerfully and absolutely tied to this little person she'd grown inside her. But the feeling had never come. No matter how hard she tried, how much she willed it, Nell remained isolated from the fierce little wildcat who sucked and tore and scratched at her breasts, always wanting more than she could give. Al, on the other hand, had been smitten, smote. He hadn't seemed to notice that the baby was a holy terror. And like most men of his generation, he was delighted to hold his daughter, to nestle her in the crook of his arm and take her walking with him down the wide Chicago streets. Sometimes Nell would watch, bland smile plastered on her face, as he gazed, love-stung, at his baby girl. He'd look up, and in his misted eyes, Nell would see reflected her own emptiness. Leslie had been born with a vein of wildness running through her, but Al's death in 1961 ruptured it. Even as Nell broke the news, she'd seen the film of jaded disillusion settle in her daughter's eyes. Over the next few months, Leslie, always something of a mystery to Nell, withdrew further into her cocoon of adolescent certainty that she despised her mother and wanted nothing more to do with her. Understandable, of course, if not acceptable. She was 14, an impressionable age, and her father had been the apple of her eye. The move back to Australia hadn't helped, but that was retrospect talking. Nell knew better than to allow exhibits of hindsight into the court of self-blame. She'd done what seemed best at the time. She wasn't an American. Al's ma had died a few years earlier, and to all intents and purposes, they were alone. Strangers in a strange land. When Leslie left home at 17, hitched her way over Australia's east hip and down its thigh to Sydney, Nell had been happy enough to let her go. With Leslie out of the house, she figured she might finally get shot of the black dog that had sat on her back for the past 17 years, whispering that of course she was a terrible mother. Of course her daughter couldn't stand her. It was in the blood. She hadn't deserved children in the first place. No matter how warm Lil had been, Nell came from a tradition of bad mothers, the sort who could abandon their children with ease. And it hadn't turned out so badly. 12 years later, and Leslie was close at her home now, living on the Gold Coast with her latest fellow and her own daughter, Cassandra. Nell had only met the girl a couple of times. Lord knew who the father was. Nell refrained from asking. Whatever the case, he must have had some sense about him, for the granddaughter showed little of the mother's wildness. Quite the opposite. Cassandra was a child whose soul seemed aged before her time. Quiet, patient, thoughtful, loyal to Leslie, a beautiful child, really. There was an underlying seriousness, somber blue eyes whose edges turned down, and a pretty mouth that Nell suspected might be glorious if she ever smiled with unwary joy. The black-and-white taxi came to a halt outside the Qantas doors, and as Nell handed the driver his fare, she pushed all thought of Leslie and Cassandra aside. She'd spent enough of her life waylaid by regret, drowning in untruths and uncertainty. Now was the time for answers, to find out who she was. She hopped out and glanced skyward as a rumbling plane flew low overhead. "Have a good trip, love," said the taxi driver, carrying Nell's suitcases to a waiting trolley. "Yes, I will." And she would. Answers were finally within reach. After a lifetime of being a shadow, she was to become flesh and blood. The little white suitcase had been the key, or rather its contents had. The book of fairy tales published in London in 1913, the picture as its frontispiece. Nell had recognised the storyteller's face immediately. Some deep and ancient part of her brain provided the names before her conscious mind caught up. Names she had thought belonged only to a childhood game. The lady. The authoress. Not only did she now know the lady was real, she also knew her name. Eliza Makepeace. Her first thought, naturally enough, was that this Eliza Makepeace was her mother. When she'd made inquiries at the library, she had clenched her fists as she waited, hoping the librarian would discover that Eliza Makepeace had lost a child, spent her life searching for a missing daughter. But it was, of course, too simple an explanation. The librarian had found very little on Eliza, but enough to know the writer going by that name had been childless. The passenger lists had offered little more elucidation. Nell had checked every ship that left London for Maryborough in late 1913, but the name Eliza Makepeace appeared on none of them. There was a chance Eliza had written under a nom de plume, of course, and had booked passage under her real name, or even an invented one. But Hugh hadn't told Nell which ship she'd arrived on, and without that knowledge, there was no way of narrowing the list of possibilities. Nonetheless, Nell was undeterred. Eliza Makepeace was important, had played some role in her past. She remembered Eliza. Not clearly. They were old memories and long repressed, but they were real. Being on a boat, waiting, hiding, playing. And she was beginning to recall other things, too. It was as if remembering the authoress had lifted some sort of lid. Jagged memories began to appear. A maze, an old woman who frightened her, a long journey across the water. Through Eliza, she knew, she would find herself, and to find Eliza, she needed to go to London. Thank God she'd had the money to afford the flight. Thank her father, really, for he'd had more to do with it than God. Inside the white suitcase, alongside the book of fairy tales, the hairbrush, the little girl's dress, Nell had found a letter from Hugh, tied up with a photograph and a check. Not a fortune. He hadn't been a wealthy man, but enough to make a difference. In his letter, he'd said he wanted her to have a little something extra, hadn't wanted the other girls to know. He'd helped them out financially during his life, but Nell had always refused assistance. This way, he figured, she couldn't say no. Then he'd apologized, written that he hoped some day she might forgive him, even if he'd never been able to forgive himself. It might please her to know he'd never got over his guilt, that it had crippled him. He'd spent his life wishing he'd never told her, and if he'd been a braver man, he'd have wished he hadn't kept her. To wish that would be to wish Nell out of his life, though, and he preferred to keep his guilt than give her up. The photograph was one she'd seen before, though not for a long time. It was black and white, more rightly brown and white, taken decades ago. Hugh, Lil, and Nell, before the sisters came along and stretched their family with laughter and loud voices and girlish shrieks. It was one of those studio shots where the frame's inhabitants look a little startled, like they've been plucked from real life, made miniature, then repositioned inside a doll's house full of unfamiliar props. Looking at it, Nell had the surest feeling that she could remember it being taken. She couldn't recall much from her childhood, but she sure as hell remembered the instant dislike she'd taken to that studio, the chemical smell of the developing fluids. She put the photo aside then, and picked up her father's letter again. No matter how many times she read it, she found herself wondering at his choice of words. His guilt. She supposed he meant he was guilty for having thrown her life into disarray with his confession, and yet the words sat uneasily. Sorry, perhaps. Regretful.
but guilty? It seemed an odd choice. For no matter how much Nell wished it hadn't happened, no matter that she'd found it impossible to continue on in a life she knew was false, she had never thought her parents culpable. After all, they'd only done what they thought best. What was best? They'd given her a home and love when she'd been without. That her father had thought himself guilty, had imagined that she might think him so, was disquieting. And yet, it was too late now to ask him what he meant. Chapter 9. Maryborough, 1914. Nell had been with them 6 months when the letter arrived at the port office. A man in London was looking for a little girl, 4 years of age. Hair red, eyes blue. She'd been missing near on 8 months, and the fellow, Henry Mansell, said the letter, had reason to believe she'd been boarded on a ship, possibly a transport headed for Australia. He was seeking her on behalf of his clients, the child's family. Standing by his desk, Hugh felt his knees buckle, his muscles liquefy. The moment he'd been dreading, had surely always known was coming, was upon him. For despite what Lil believed, children, especially children like Nell, didn't go missing without someone raising the alarm. He sat in his chair, concentrated on breathing, looked quickly at the windows. He felt suddenly conspicuous, as if he were being watched by an unseen foe. He ran a hand over his face, then rested it across his neck. What the hell was he going to do? It was only a matter of time before the other fellows arrived on the job and saw the letter. And although it was true he was the only one who'd seen Nell waiting alone on the wharf, that wouldn't keep them safe for long. Word would get out in the town, it always did, and someone would put two and two together. Would realize that the little girl staying with the O'Connors on Queen Street, the one with the unusual way of speaking, sounded an awful lot like the little English girl who was missing. No, he couldn't risk anyone reading the contents. Hugh observed himself, his hand shaking a little. He folded the letter neatly in half, then in half again, and put it inside his coat pocket. That'd take care of it for now. He sat down. There, he felt better already. He just needed time and space to think, to work out how he was going to convince Lil that the time had come to give Nell back. Plans for the move to Brisbane were already well underway. Lil had given word to the landlord that they'd be vacating. She'd started packing their possessions, such as they were, had put word around town that there were opportunities for Hugh in Brisbane that they'd be fools to pass up. But plans could be cancelled, would have to be cancelled. For now they knew there was someone looking for Nell. Well, that changed things, didn't it? He knew what Lil would say to that. They didn't deserve Nell, these people. This man, Henry Mansell, who had lost her. She'd beg him, plead with him, insist they couldn't possibly hand Nell over to someone who could be so careless. But Hugh would make her see that it wasn't a question of choice, that Nell wasn't theirs, had never been theirs, that she belonged to someone else. She wasn't even Nell anymore. Her own name was looking for her. When he climbed the front stairs that afternoon, Hugh stood for a moment collecting his thoughts. As he breathed the acrid smoke drifting from the chimney, pleasant for having come from the fire that warmed his hearth, some unseen force seemed to lock him into place. He had the vague sense of standing on a threshold, the crossing of which would change everything. He breathed deeply, pushed open the door, and his two girls turned to face him. They were sitting by the fire, Nell on Lil's lap, her long red hair hanging in wet strands as Lil combed it.
Pah!
Said Nell, excitement animating a face already pink with warmth. Lil smiled at him over the top of the little one's head. The smile that had always been his undoing. Ever since he'd first set eyes on her, coiling the ropes down at her father's boat shed. When was the last time he'd seen that smile? It was before the babies, he knew. The babies of theirs that refused to be born right. Hugh met Lil's smile, then set down his bag, reached inside his pocket where the letter was burning its hole, felt its smoothness beneath his fingertips. He turned towards the range where the biggest pot was steaming.
"Dinner smells good," blasted Frog in his throat.
"My ma's morgy broth," said Lil, picking at the tangles in Nell's hair.
"You coming down with something?"
"What's that?"
"I'll make you up some lemon and barley."
"Only a tickle," said Hugh. "No need for bother."
"No bother. Not for you."
She smiled at him again and patted Nell's shoulders. "There now, little one. Ma's got to jump up now and check on the tea. You sit here until your hair dries. Don't want you catching a chill like your pa here."
She glanced at Hugh as she spoke, eyes loaded with a contentment that poked at his heart so that he had to turn away.
All through dinner, the letter sat heavy in Hugh's pocket, refusing to be forgotten. Like metal to a magnet, his hand was drawn. He couldn't put his knife down to rest without his fingers slipping into his coat, rubbing against the smooth paper. Death sentence to their happiness. The letter from a man who knew Nell's family. Well, at least that's what he said.
Hugh straightened suddenly, wondering at the way he'd immediately accepted this stranger's claims. He thought again of the letter's contents, pulled the lines from his memory and scanned them through for evidence. The flood of cool relief was instant. There was nothing, nothing in the letter that suggested for certain it was truth. There were any number of queer people out there engaged in all kinds of complicated schemes. There was a market for little girls in some countries, he knew that. White slavers were always on the lookout for little girls to sell. But it was ridiculous. Even as he clutched desperately at such possibilities, he knew how unlikely they were.
"Hughie?"
He looked up quickly. Lil was watching him in a funny way.
"You're away with the fairies."
She laid a warm palm against his forehead.
"Hope you're not coming down with a fever."
"I'm fine." Sharper than he intended. "I'm fine, little love."
She pressed her lips together.
"I was just saying. I'm going to take this little lady into bed. She's had a big day, all tuckered out."
As if on cue, Nell surrendered to a huge yawn.
"Good night, Pa," she said contentedly when the yawn was done with. Before he knew it, she was in his lap, curled into him like a warm kitten, arms snaked around his neck. He was aware as never before of the roughness of his skin, the whiskers on his cheeks. He folded his arms around her bird-like back and closed his eyes.
"Good night, Nellie, love," he whispered into her hair.
He watched them disappear then into the other room. His family. For in some way that he couldn't explain, even to himself, this child, their Nell with her two long plaits, lent a solidity to him and Lil. They were a family now, an unbreakable unit of three, not just two souls who'd decided to put their lot in together. And here he was, considering breaking it apart. A sound in the hall, and he looked up. Lil, framed beneath the wooden fretwork, watching him. Some trick of the light drew red from her dark hair and planted a glow deep within her eyes, black moons beneath their long lashes. A thread of feeling tugged at the corner where her lips met, pulling her mouth into the sort of smile that described an emotion too powerful to be expressed verbally. Hugh smiled back tentatively, and his fingers slipped once more into his pocket, ran silently across the surface of the letter. His lips parted with a soft click, tingled with the words he didn't want to speak, but wasn't sure he could stop. Lil was by his side then, her fingers on his wrist sent hot shocks to his neck, her warm hand on his cheek. "Come to bed." Ah, were there ever words as sweet as those? Her voice contained a promise, and, like that, his mind was made. He slipped his hand into hers, held it firm, and followed as she led. As he passed the fireplace, he tossed the paper on top. It sizzled as it caught, burned a brief reproach on his peripheral vision. But he didn't stop. He just kept walking and never looked back. Chapter 10. Brisbane, 2005. Long before it was an antique centre, it had been a theatre. The Plaza Theatre, a grand experiment in the 1930s. Plain from the outside, a huge white box cut into the Paddington hillside, its interior was another story. The vaulted ceiling, midnight blue with cut-out clouds, had been backlit originally to create the illusion of moonlight, while hundreds of tiny lights twinkled like stars. It had done a roaring trade for decades, back in the days when trams had rattled along the terrace and Chinese gardens had flourished in the valleys. But though it had prevailed against such fierce adversaries as fire and flood, it had fallen victim softly and swiftly to television in the 60s. Nell and Cassandra's stall was directly below the proscenium arch, stage left. A rabbit warren of shelves obscured by countless pieces of bric-a-brac, odds and ends, old books, and an eclectic assortment of memorabilia. Long ago, the other dealers had started calling it Aladdin's, as a joke, and the name had stuck. A small wooden sign with gold lettering now proclaimed the area Aladdin's Den. Sitting on a three-legged stool, deep within the maze of shelves, Cassandra was finding it difficult to concentrate. It was the first time she'd been inside the centre since Nell's death, and it felt strange to sit amongst the treasures they'd assembled together. Odd that the stock should still be here when Nell was gone. Disloyal of it, somehow. Spoons that Nell had polished, price tickets with her indecipherable spider's web scrawl across them, books and more books. They'd been Nell's weakness. Every dealer had one. In particular, she loved books written at the end of the 19th century. Late Victorian, with glorious printed texts and black and white illustrations. If a book bore a message from giver to recipient, so much the better. A record of its past, a hint as to the hands it had passed through in order to make its way to her. Morning. Cassandra looked up to see Ben holding out a takeaway coffee. "Sorting stock," he said. She brushed a few fine strands of hair from her eyes and took the proffered drink. "Moving things from here to there, back again, most times." Ben took a sip of his own coffee, eyed her over his cup. "I've got something for you." He reached beneath his knitted vest to withdraw a folded piece of paper from his shirt pocket. Cassandra opened the page and flattened out its creases. Printer paper, white A4, a patchy black and white picture of a house at the centre. A cottage, really. Stone, from what she could make out, with blotches, creepers perhaps, across the walls. The roof was tiled, a stone chimney visible behind the peak. Two pots balanced precariously at its top.
She knew what this house was, of course. Didn't need to ask.
Been having a bit of a dig, said Ben. Couldn't help myself. My daughter in London managed to make contact with someone in Cornwall and sent me this photo over the email.
So this was what it looked like. Nell's big secret. The house she'd bought on a whim and kept to herself all this time. Strange, the picture's effect on her. Cassandra had left the deed on the kitchen table all weekend, had looked at it each time she walked past, thought of little else. But seeing this picture was the first time it had felt real. Everything came into sharp focus. Nell, who went to her grave not knowing who she really was, had bought a house in England and left it to Cassandra, had thought she'd understand why.
Ruby's always had a knack for finding things out, so I set her to chasing up information about past owners. I thought if we knew who your grandma bought the house from, it might shed a little light on why.
Ben pulled a small spiral notebook from his breast pocket and angled his glasses to best observe the page.
Do the names Richard and Julia Bennett mean anything to you?
Cassandra shook her head, still looking at the picture.
According to Ruby, Nell bought the property from Mr. and Mrs. Bennett, who themselves bought it in 1971. They bought the nearby manor house, too. Turned it into a hotel. The Blackhurst Hotel.
He looked at Cassandra hopefully. Again she shook her head.
You sure?
Never heard of it.
Said Ben, shoulders seeming to deflate. Ah, well then.
He flicked the notebook shut and leaned his arm on the nearest bookcase.
I'm afraid that's the extent of my sleuthing. Long shot, I suppose.
He scratched his beard.
Typical of Nell to leave a mystery like this. It's the darndest thing, isn't it? A secret house in England.
Cassandra smiled. Thanks for the picture. And thank your daughter for me.
You can thank her yourself when you're over that side of the pond.
He shook his takeaway cup, then eyed the sipping hole to check that it was empty.
When do you think you'll go?
Cassandra's eyes widened. You mean to England?
Aw, pictures all well and good, but it's not the same as really seeing a place, is it?
You think I should go to England?
Why not? 21st century? You could be there and back inside a week, and you'll have a much better idea of what you want to do with the cottage.
Despite the deed lying plain on her table, Cassandra had been so preoccupied with the theoretical fact of Nell's cottage, she'd failed completely to consider it in practical terms. There was a cottage in England waiting for her. She scuffed at the dull timber floor, then peered through her fringe at Ben. I guess I should sell it.
Big decision to make without setting foot inside.
Ben tossed his cup into the overflowing rubbish bin by the cedar desk.
Wouldn't hurt to take a look, eh? It obviously meant a lot to Nell to have kept it all this time.
Cassandra considered this. Fly to England, by herself, out of the blue.
But the stall, prah! Centre staff will take care of your sales, and I'll be here.
He indicated the laden shelves.
You've got enough stock to last through the next decade.
His voice softened.
Why not go, Cass? Wouldn't hurt to get away for a bit. Ruby's living in a shoebox in South Kensington, working at the V&A. She'll show you around. Look after you.
Look after her. People were always offering to look after Cassandra. Once, a lifetime ago, she'd been a grown-up with her own responsibilities, had looked after others.
What have you got to lose?
Nothing. She had nothing to lose. No one to lose. Cassandra was suddenly weary of the topic. She hoisted a slight, yielding smile and added an, "I'll think about it," for good measure.
There's a girl.
He patted her shoulder and made to leave.
Oh, almost forgot. I did turn up another interesting little tidbit. Sheds no light on Nell and her house, but it's a funny coincidence all the same. What with your art background. All those drawings you used to do.
To hear years of one's life, one's passion, described so casually, relegated so absolutely to the past, was breathtaking. Cassandra managed to keep a weak smile afloat.
The estate that Nell's house is on used to be owned by the Mountrachet family.
The name meant nothing, and Cassandra shook her head. He raised an eyebrow.
The daughter, Rose, married a certain Nathaniel Walker.
Cassandra frowned. An artist? An American?
That's the one. Portraits mostly, you know, the sort of thing. Lady so-and-so and her six favourite poodles. According to my daughter, he even did one of King Edward in 1910, just before he died. Pinnacle of Walker's career, I'd say, though Ruby seemed unimpressed. She said his portraits weren't his best work, that they were a bit lifeless.
It's been a while since I...
She preferred his sketches. That's Ruby, though, always happiest when she's swimming against the current of popular opinion. Sketches? Illustrations, magazine pictures, black and white.
Cassandra inhaled sharply. The Maze and Fox drawings. Ben lifted his shoulders and shook his head.
Oh, Ben, they were incredible, are incredible, amazingly detailed.
It had been so long since she'd thought about art history, it surprised her, this surge of ownership. Nathaniel Walker came up briefly in a class I took on Aubrey Beardsley and his contemporaries, she said. He was controversial, from what I remember, but I can't recall why.
That's what Ruby said. You're going to get on well with her. When I mentioned him, she was very excited. She said they have a few of his illustrations in the new exhibition at the V&A. Evidently, they're very rare.
He didn't do many, said Cassandra, remembering now. I suppose he was too busy with the portraits. The illustrations were more of a hobby. All the same, those he did were very well regarded. She started. I think we might have one here, in one of Nell's books. She climbed onto an upturned milk crate and ran her index finger along the top shelf, stopped when she reached a burgundy spine with faded gold lettering. She opened it, still standing on the crate, and flicked carefully through the colour plates in the front. Here it is. Without taking her eyes from the page, she stepped down. The Fox's Lament. Ben came to stand by her, adjusted his glasses away from the light.
Intricate, isn't it? Not my cup of tea, but that's art for you. I can see what you admire about it.
It's beautiful, and somehow sad. He leaned closer.
Sad?
Full of melancholy, yearning. I can't explain better than that. Something in the fox's face, some sort of absence. She shook her head. I can't explain. Ben gave her arm a squeeze, murmured something about bringing her a sandwich at lunchtime, and then he was gone. Shuffling in the direction of his stall, more particularly the customer in his stall, who was juggling the pieces of a Waterford chandelier. Cassandra continued to study the picture, wondering how it was she felt so sure about the fox's sorrow.
That was the artist's skill, of course. The ability through precise positioning of thin black lines to evoke so clearly such complex emotions. Her lips tightened. The sketch reminded her of the day she'd found the book of fairy tales, when she'd been filling time beneath Nell's house, as upstairs her mother prepared to leave her. Looking back, Cassandra realized she could trace her love of art to that book. She'd opened the front cover and fallen inside the wonderful, frightening, magical illustrations. She'd wondered what it must feel like to escape the rigid boundaries of words and speak instead with such a fluid language. And for a time, as she grew older, she had known the alchemical pull of the pen, the blissful sensation of time losing meaning as she conjured at her drawing board. Her love of art had led her to study in Melbourne, had led her to marry Nicholas, and to everything else that had followed. Strange to think that life might have been completely different had she never seen the suitcase, had she not felt the curious compulsion to open it and look inside. Cassandra gasped. Why hadn't she thought of it before? Suddenly she knew exactly what she had to do, where she had to look. The one place where she might uncover the necessary clues to Nell's mysterious origins. That Nell might have rid herself of the suitcase occurred to Cassandra, but she pushed the notion aside with some certainty. For one thing, her grandmother was an antiques dealer, a collector, a bower bird of the human species. It would have been completely out of character for her to destroy or discard something old and rare. More importantly, if what the aunts had said was true, the suitcase wasn't a mere historical artifact. It was an anchor. It was all Nell had that linked her to her past. Cassandra understood the importance of anchors, knew all too well what happened to a person when the rope that tied them to their life was cut. She had lost her own anchor twice. The first time as a 10-year-old when Leslie had left her, the second, as a young woman, was it really a decade ago, when, in a split second, life as she knew it had changed, and she'd been cast adrift once more. Later, when she looked back upon events, Cassandra knew it was the suitcase that found her, just as it had done the first time. After a night spent combing through Nell's cluttered spare rooms, becoming distracted, despite her best intentions, by this memento or that, she'd grown incredibly weary. Not just bone-tired, but brain-tired. The weekend had taken its toll. It came over her quickly and profoundly, the weariness of fairy tales, a magical desire to surrender herself to sleep. Rather than go downstairs to her own room, she curled up beneath Nell's bedspread, still in her clothes, and let her head sink into the downy pillow. The smell was breathtakingly familiar. Lavender talcum powder, silver polish, palm olive laundry flakes, and she felt as if she were resting her head on Nell's chest. She slept like the dead, dark and dreamless. And next morning, when she woke, she had the sense of having been asleep far longer than one night. The sun was streaming into the room through the gap between the curtains, like the light from a lighthouse. And she watched, as she lay there, the pieces of